Hello and welcome to the Reuters Report podcast, where we enrich businesses through business advisors. This podcast is your source for information and news you need for your accounting, bookkeeping, or tax practice, and it is proudly sponsored by Expensify and Rightworks. For more information about both Expensify and Rightworks, please visit woodard.com/podcast. And now your hosts, Joe Woodard and Heather Satterley.
Well, Heather, here we are again, and we've got a topic here I think that'll be extremely relevant to everybody listening in. It's about how we don't get things right with technology. I know that's a topic near and dear to your heart.
It sure is, Joe. Yeah, I've messed that up quite a bit in my career, actually, and learned from it.
I was coming from the other angle. You're the guru. You're the queen of technology, but thanks for the transparency, because I don't think any of our listeners haven't messed this up, right?
Right.
Question is,
what I meant by that is you learn from your mistakes, right? So I've become so good at it because I have messed it up so frequently early in my career.
Yeah, all of my lessons I learned the easy way. I didn't do it that way, but thank you for sharing. So let's get through these five technology fails. Now, obviously, there are more than five. These are the five that I see that are most prevalent, not only with you listeners, but also with your clients. So you can not become a technology advisor. I don't want you to necessarily change occupations, but you can have your eyes open and you can maybe point at things that are broken and then refer them to an IT consultant or somebody else if it's not your swim lane. But these are the five things I've seen that are most prevalent. One is locally stored files. See, you might have thought you were going to pass the test until the first question's the hardest to pass. And you're like, Joe, I've already at best got an 80 grade on this. If there are five questions, I failed the first one. If you have any files stored on what is called a C drive, or in Linux terms, which is the operating system for Mac, is called something else. But if you've got stuff in desktop drives, then you have already failed the first technology fail. And I mean anything that is of any significant value or any security risk, either one of those, if it has collaborative value, if it's related to a client, or it's something that is a sensitive document and is sitting on a hard drive, not only is it in an unsafe location, because anybody who can get possession of that piece of equipment has that data, I don't care how password protected you are, they have it. The other reason that you don't want to do it is because in a multi-practitioner firm, it's not collaborative. And even in a single practitioner firm, if you're creating the proper client experience, any client-related documents should be accessible to your clients on demand as well through a client portal or other kind of collaborative document sharing system. So once you place it onto that hard drive, it's insecure and it's in what I refer to as a data prison. Some people call it a data silo. A data prison sounds more fun. And you have become the data imprisoner by sticking it into that data prison. So
I'm going to lighten the mood for just a minute, Joe, by saying I do think that there is some data out there that really does belong in a prison.
Yeah, but maybe a sky prison, not a desktop prison. Because remember, it's not just the privacy piece of it, which we're going to talk about in just a minute, Heather. That is kind of funny what you just said. Lots of implications to that. But the point is, yes, there are some things that you want to be very private, but then the other side of the equation, it still has to be secure. And maybe that thing where privacy matters most is where security also matters most. And like, I don't want my laptop to be lifted at an airport or a Sky Club lounge or while I'm going to the bathroom on an airplane or whatever it might be. And then all of a sudden, all of that data is in the hands of some bad actor.
Absolutely.
Yep. Okay. So get it off your hard drive. And if you've got data sitting around on hard drives, right, you've got to get those into Sky containers. I understand some of these files can be very large. We have video files from all of our main stage breakout sessions. There's gigs and gigs and gigs of data, terabytes of data. And we do place them temporarily onto hard drives, but then we find really inexpensive storage space in the cloud. We spend a month of upload time until it just gets up to the cloud, to a place where we can get to it and work with it and not have to data silo it. Back before we did that, the drives lived in my basement and we're a virtual company. Somebody needed to get to a particular section of footage or view something. Talk about a data prison. I mean, I'd even have to go dig it out of the shelf in our basement, then figure out how to get it to the person that needed to be able to see it. So now, ideally, these non-local storage devices are heavily indexed too, because that's another place of data liberation. But the biggest takeaway here is just get it off the ground, get it into the sky, and pick something in the sky that's collaborative with you, your team members, your clients, and incredibly secure. And the two most stable places are Microsoft SharePoint, Google Drive. But there's also the other known players, Box, Dropbox, any of those that are collaborative, democratized, shared across your team, and accessible appropriately to your clients. That would be the gold standard. All right. Now, number two, lack of security. Now, I know I mentioned security. One of the ways we're insecure is by storing files locally, but it's just one little piece of it. Your company, even if it's just you and the company, should have a data security and privacy policy. I know that sounds like a daunting task, but there are prescripted data security and privacy policies out there. You can hire consultants who will use boilerplates, customize it slightly, do it at a fair rate. Then you can think about all the different areas of your company where you might have weaknesses. The point of this policy is not for regulatory enforcement of most companies listening to this podcast. Even my company with 20 team members, we're just now getting to the point where it's about making sure everybody stays on policy per SOP. But if you've got a smaller firm, you might think, well, I don't need this. It's just all of us kind of honor system. We'll just handshake it. I'll just take a look at their computers every once in a while. No, you do need to have a policy because it affects everything from the way your client's data is protected to the promises that you make implied or non-implied. Explicit in this case is better than implied because they'll infer too much. And it can even affect your professional insurance coverage on any given case or a matter because you have to read the fine print in your insurance policies. You need to make sure you have cyber insurance, which they will often not grant to you unless you have the data security and privacy policy in place. And then, of course, if you adhere to the security and privacy policy, then you will avoid the actual technology fail that it is designed to prevent. So you have administrative and technological fails here if you do not deploy.
And for our tax practitioners, the IRS has some resources out there to help you create that WISP document, because we are required as tax practitioners to safeguard our clients' data, and we have to have a written policy to do that. So if you haven't done that already and you're a tax practitioner, we have some great articles out on the Woodard Report that can lead you in the right direction, but the IRS has also created some great resources. And I'll drop those in our show notes so people have
them. Yeah, please. Yeah, drop them in the show notes because, you know, when these regs first came out, they were saying you had to have one, and then they provided very little guidance into what that one thing was, right?
Right.
You know, and now I will tell you there's a great company out there, you know, because you might say, well, Joe, if there's a company out there that can do it, could you have anybody that you've worked with in the past? Yes, we do have a company. They're not the only ones, and we're not necessarily providing an endorsement here on this podcast, but I can just point you in the direction of somebody we know our listeners and members have thought well of. It's a company called Practice Protect. They will do a data security, privacy, and policy review. They will consult with you on the development of a policy, and they will work with you on everything from virus protection to IT consulting to password vault protection. To comply with this policy. And that would be one of the things that I would mention in this number two is password handling, which is a great segue to sort of process, but it's still in this policy solution and systems piece. If you are storing passwords inside of your browser, inside of Chrome or Edge, if you're still using Firefox, CompuServe, whatever it is you may be using, that CompuServe thing was a joke. If you are storing wherever you're storing, per Randy Johnston, that is not secure enough. Now, I know Edge and I know Chrome have done a lot to thicken up the vault part of their password storage. And there's multi-factor authentication that's layered into that. Okay. I still tend to say if Randy Johnston says it's not safe, I just trust what he's saying. And what he's saying is it's not as safe as using something like LastPass, which is one of the industry standards. Now, I know LastPass just had their own security breach, which means there is no safe, truly safe place. But there are safer places. And just keep in mind, if you do happen to engage Practice Protect, they have their own software, their own password vault that comes, but it's only for use by accountants. Don't refer your clients to Practice Protect. They're only for accountants.
You know, the other thing that I'm just going to mention, Joe, is that we have a couple of sessions coming up at Scaling New Heights in June that are going to tackle this. One of them, we just had Randy Johnston just did a session for our monthly town hall, where he was talking about LastPass, and he actually gave us some great tips on some that he recommends, some password apps that he recommends, and he's going to be talking about those during his tech update session on Sunday. So
yes, absolutely. Yeah. And he still is a believer in LastPass, even with the security breach, but it was the way they handled it. Everybody has mm-hmm. their own moment right. here, but they had created multiple tranches of protection. They protected most consumer data. They were very quick to disclose. They were very quick to remedy. And that's the best you can hope for in today's mm-hmm. world. I mean, even Microsoft and other companies like that have security breaches. They just lock them down and then they report them and we move on with our lives. So LastPass is still something Randy believes in, as well as some other password vaults that he'll talk about at Scaling New Heights. All right. So then process. Once you have all your data in the cloud, once you have all of the policies, solutions, and systems you need, which also include virus protection, malware protection, so forth, if you're using Microsoft, you're going to want to use Active Directory, Intune, solutions like that that will allow you to remote wipe hardware to control what's happening on computer-managed hardware. We're not going to go that deep down the rabbit hole. Just understand that the security piece has policies, solutions, and systems. But once you have that, you have to have processes in place to govern adherence to policies, to solutions, and to systems. And if you think that people in your company haven't installed unauthorized apps, that's magical thinking. They have installed them. The only question is, how much are you aware of it? How much are you checking on whether those solutions meet your policy or not? And do you need to remove those solutions from their hard drive or from their systems? You know, when do these checks take place? Well, that's a standard operating process or procedure. But employee onboarding, employee offboarding are forms of processes that involve technology succeed or fail. And if you have policies, solutions, and systems, and you don't have processes to enforce them, to regulate them, and to consistently deploy them, you have an academic answer to the technology fail problem. So far, we've talked about locally stored files. We've talked about a general lack of security, which I would put into policies, systems, and solutions. And then a lack of process. I've got two more. So if you're still in a passing grade, that's great, listeners. Hang in there. If you've already failed the test, that's okay, because you can pass by correcting. So old hardware. It's really funny to me. Funny, ha, not ha ha. Funny, like weird, strange. How much we will chase after an old antiquated piece of hardware. I think that it's a little bit of the 20th century thinking syndrome that we've brought into the 21st century. Back when computers used to be major purchases, like buying a car, we really thought this was a big deal. And we used to go down to the store. We used to research all of our options. We used to actually, you know, bring it home and unbox it and celebrate it like it was this amazing thing. And then there was a moment of sadness, almost like, you know, when you have to let go of that car you've had for 10 years, right? Remember when it was a major asset purchase, Heather? When the psychology of that? I think some of the folks that had their first computer in the 90s and early 2000s are still tethered to that thinking. But I want you to untether yourself to that thinking. That laptop that you carry around with you is just a shell of aluminum and fixed parts, and it doesn't need to stay in your hand long. We used to think this way about our phones too. I mean, I've gotten to the place now where it's not an event when I upgrade my phone. I just did it on the way to dinner one night with my family. It took just seconds. I did it at the last possible minute because I don't care. I just want the hardware to work, but the battery wasn't working right. Showed up to dinner on time, had the new phone, didn't even tell them I had a new phone in my pocket. It's a non-event. Right. It was months later when they found out I had a new phone and they didn't care. You need to start thinking that way with your laptop. Stop being nostalgic about that thing. Stop holding on to that thing. And I'll tell you what else tethers us into to waiting too long. We have too many locally stored files. That gets us back to the other problem. So when we go to, we're thinking, I'm not going to try to move all that data. Well, when you're cloud, you're not moving anything. It's a dumb terminal, right? And even now, if you're going like Mac to Mac, and PC's starting to do it with a lot of their apps, it just reloads everything the moment that you type in your user profile, and you could just go work on any computer anyway. So I wouldn't keep a computer longer than 2 years. That's not a 3 at the most. If you're buying at the $2,000 level or higher, you can keep the hardware for about 3 years. If you're buying at the $1,200 to $1,500 level, you can keep it about 2 years. Never buy a laptop for less than $1,200. It's a waste of money. Okay. Now, the other factor, and I want to hear your thoughts on this, Heather, is the productivity loss. We don't factor in that all this data needs to be stored in the cloud, and we don't factor in what keeping old hardware around costs us. Chasing outlets at airports because our battery doesn't hold, not getting work done on the plane because our battery doesn't hold, and having slow startups, having to reboot, having programs run slower, having crashes, all of these things. All it takes is about 10 or 15 of those things, and depending on how you, what your productivity value is for your for your practice, it could cost you a whole laptop just in lost productivity. All right, Heather, thoughts?
Yeah, no, actually, it was just a question, Joe. What do you think about warranties on your equipment? So what do you think about that, and what do you recommend?
Well, drop protection, if you have a laptop, I think is more important than a warranty, because by the time that warranty wears out, I will have already scrapped that thing and bought something new. So I would only worry about warranties or extending those manufacturer warranties if you're going to hold on to hardware longer than 2 to 3 years, which I just recommended you don't do. But drop protection is absolutely key. Spend your money there instead. And maybe if you've got someone that's traveling very heavy, loss protection. All right. So the fifth one is lack of vetting with the software that we adopt. We have this blind trust in the cloud software community that if something exists in that space, we can just deploy it. And we have several considerations we have to make. There's one, are they SOC 2 compliant, or through our own vetting process, have we determined that they're SOC 2 compliant, you know, commensurate or eligible? Do they have their own privacy and security policies? What are they? Do they protect their users from the sale of the data, from unauthorized access by their own employees to the data? What are their backup protocols? Where's their data stored, onshore, offshore? In what kind of servers? Is it something industry standard like Microsoft Azure, or is it something that they're hosting on a desk? And I know that sounds crazy, but I worked with a lot of startups, and what you're actually accessing is a computer sitting under somebody's desk. You're just accessing it via the cloud. And we don't even ask these questions, especially when they're scrappy startups. We just go get software. And then the first thing we do is we SSO it to our Google or our Microsoft. Then we connect it to our Microsoft Exchange account or our Google account. Then we start connecting it to our accounting systems. And we don't even know who these people are. And we're giving them all of our data. And more importantly than that, we're giving them all of our clients' data. And are we seeking our clients' permission to connect third-party apps to their QBO data, because it's a form of disclosure to a third party? We don't even think about it that way. And that means that needs to be addressed in your data security and privacy policy, that you reserve the right to connect the QuickBooks Online account to third-party solutions that are vetted by that platform, by Intuit, by Xero, that are part of their approved ecosystem without the client's permission. Or state that you won't without their explicit permission, and then have a process by which they can provide this permission. All of these are things we just don't think about enough.
We don't. And I think that you probably scared a bunch of our listeners.
The goal to scare them. I'm sorry, exactly. But it was.
Yeah, right. And, you know, one thing I would just want to mention about, I just wrote an article in the last month about SOC compliance. And I think a lot of our listeners, and I myself included, is that we know about it, we know what it is, but we don't know really what it is. And so one of the things that I think is a big mistake that we make as far as SOC is we look at a vendor's website and we see that there's a SOC report. And so we assume that they're SOC compliant. But that's not the case. You have to read the report. So, you know, when you're going through and you're looking and you see they've done a SOC audit, you know, that's great. But just seeing that there has been one done does not mean that they have been certified or they're compliant. It means that they've gone through the exercise of that. So as a practitioner, as a professional, we got to look at the report.
You know, exactly. Well, it's actually an accounting function, right? The SOC 2 report, those audits are done by accounting firms, which I always thought was very interesting. But that's a really good comparison. It's not even a metaphor. It's a comparison. It's like saying, well, this company has gone through a financial audit. Therefore, they have a healthy current ratio. No, right. Their horrible current ratio has just been verified through an audit process.
Exactly. So
it's a really good point, Heather. And I would encourage everybody to read that article. I'm assuming you'll put a link to that article in the list.
Absolutely.
Yes. Okay. So anything else to add to this one?
I do. I have two things to add to technology fails, and it's coming from my experience as, you know, being a technology advisor to businesses, you know, in for such a long time. And they're related to our processes. You talked about processes as far as having an SOP and proper vetting of technology. But the other two things that I want to, well, there's three things I want to add is I think that a big technology fail is lack of comprehensive needs assessment. When you're looking at technology for yourself, for your client, you know, just going after the, you know, scratching the surface of what a company actually needs, you could end up, you know, adopting technology that does not actually solve the problem you're looking to address. You know, when we meet with our sophomore partners, their goal is to sell us their software. And so a lot of times they'll tell us things about the software that we want to hear. And we really need to make sure that we first understand what the problem is we're trying to solve. We also need to be looking at how is this new application or new technology going to play with the other technology we've already implemented in our practice. So we talk about building tech stacks. We need to be looking at the big picture. How does this fit in to what's already in place? And could it possibly be disruptive to a process that we already have established within our company? So I think that's a big fail that I see a lot where we jump the gun based on the shiny object syndrome, you know, phenomenon, and we implement something and we realize that just by implementing that, we've wasted time, efforts, money, implementing the wrong solution, or we inadvertently break something that was already working within our company. So that's one. The second one is lack of implementation planning, right? That's a huge technology fail. You know, you find the right technology, you've done all the things that you mentioned, Joe, as far as going through and vetting, but then you fail to plan and you push the button without really planning and understanding how the technology is going to fit into the greater system of your business. So I think that's something we really need to pay attention to. And then the third one is communication breakdowns. And that goes side by side with that implementation and the needs analysis is communicating with everybody who's going to be interacting with this technology so that they know what to expect, that they have the proper guidance to use the technology. And that, you know, leads into the SOPs you were talking about, but really making sure that there's strong communication throughout the entire process of implementing this new technology. So those are just things that I added just from my life, because as I mentioned, I've made the mistakes, and these are three big ones that luckily I made in my own company early on. And I've been able to come up with, you know, strategies and processes to help others avoid them.
And really they're kind of three sides of a three-sided coin there, because, you know, they're all some kind of implementation fail. And I like the way that you kind of coalesce them together underneath that. And I would say that wrapped up in your first one was also an over-medication fail. So we deploy technologies that don't necessarily work together. Well, an implementation plan will help with that, but also we over-medicate the problems, put too many technology solutions to the problem too quickly before there's an ROI or out of priority. So when you hear Heather by the way, everybody should have implementation plans. I want you to really hear Heather on this. It's not just about implementing software X, Y, or Z. It's about having an implementation plan for software, plural.
Yes.
And yes, and then prioritizing that, timelining it out, and making sure that you're doing it in a way that is prioritized, as well as minimizing disruptions, maximizing adoptions. Everything Heather said is brilliant. Okay, so now moving from that, we have our next topic, which is the TV and movie quote segment, where I always bring something and sometimes you do. So I think, I know I've got one teed up for this time. Do you?
I do. Okay. I actually do. I do have one. Here's the funny part of it. I haven't actually watched the show yet.
Oh, well, that's kind of not. That's out of sequence.
Well, okay. Not a sequence, but I'm going to dig in.
We'll still go with it. All right. Well, okay. Here, go ahead.
So the quote is, "We're not just numbers in a spreadsheet. We're people with our lives and families." And I loved that because I love, you know me, I'm big on humanity and technology, right? We've got to keep the humans in mind. And really, the show is Mr. Bates versus the Post Office. And I actually heard about this. It came up, I think, in one of my, I think may have been Amazon Prime as something that I should watch. But my good friend Heather Smith from the UK, she has the Accounting Apps podcast. She and I had a conversation. She was telling me about an interview that she did with Tom Herbert from Accounting Web over in the UK about this show. So what is the show about? The show is about the greatest technology fail in the history of the UK and the biggest miscarriage of justice. So the story is about how the Post Office in the UK implemented technology. They implemented a point of sale system for their post office by Fujitsu. And what happened in the implementation is the sub postmasters, which is kind of like a franchise, they were coming up short on their daily or weekly reconciliations of their point of sale software. And the policy of the post office in the UK was the sub-postmasters were financially responsible for anything that they came up short. Now, this software was implemented in 1999. And over that time, there were over 200 prosecutions and convictions of sub-postmasters based on a software flaw. I don't want to give away all the details. The podcast itself, which you can find the link to Heather's podcast, fantastic. They kind of dig deep into the show and give you insights from the accountant brain, because this is all about what we do with clients is uncovering these types of flaws within an accounting system, within technology tech stack. And that's really what happened here, is that the software was flawed and they ended up imprisoning people. I don't want to give away too much. Listen to the podcast.
Yeah,
but it's crazy. It just now, people are starting to get compensation for, you know, these miscarriages of justice where there was no theft, yet all these people were prosecuted. Some people lost their homes. 4 people committed suicide from it. Their lives were literally destroyed.
All over a technology fail.
Exactly. And the cover-up. It's
crazy.
Yeah.
It's crazy. All right. Thank you for sharing that, Heather. I'm looking forward to listening to that podcast, learning more about this crazy thing that took place. My show is Yellowstone, a little bit less astute, but okay, lots of fun. And I know I've quoted Yellowstone here before, it's so quote worthy. You could probably get 100 of these out of just those 6 or 7 seasons they've had so far. And in one of these places, John Dutton is saying to his son, who's going off to law school, and he's saying, "Well, Dad, I'd like to stay back and work the ranch," but he's sending him off to law school. And he says this, he says, "Lawyers are the swords of this century. Words are weapons now. I need you to learn how to use them." Now, this was taking place in the late 20th century, but it's still applicable today. It's just applicable in a little bit of a different way. This is my commentary. In the late 20th century, lawyers were the ones that weaponized the words. In the late 20th century, all the way through to today, media organizations weaponize words. That has been the case for the last 40, 50 years or longer, really ever since there was the first political propaganda. Media organizations, political figures have been weaponizing words since the legal profession was a legal profession and there was criminal crime and justice. Lawyers have been weaponizing words. So nothing new here. It's just that it's escalated in the late 20th century, early 21st century, to where they were doing it at sort of a scale of World War III in terms of weaponization. I would say that's still the case with the media. They're still weaponizing words on all sides of the war. Lawyers are losing their power in this weaponization. They're not the primary sword holders anymore. It's now a matter of procedural law and interpretation and case precedent and fewer things go to trial and so forth, right? There's still some of it. You know, cases are argued to the Supreme Court, so forth. But let me tell you where the real war of words is being fought. It's in social media. So, it's a war that's being fought now where it's the primary sword holder, the primary weaponization, and it's more powerful than the lawyers. It's more powerful than the major media outlets, and it's more powerful even than our politicians. Our politicians are bowing to the power of social media's weaponization of words. And what's really interesting about this, not to get on some tirade about it, is just to kind of play off the quote, and this is sort of our free moment to share kind of whatever we think. On all sides of the political spectrum, this weaponization is extremely dangerous because it's mixed with misinformation and it's bot-driven. It's infused with narratives from bad actors, local and abroad, and almost never is the entire story conveyed. Now, you could say the same thing is true of a lawyer who's arguing only one side of a case, but at least there's a counter argument that takes place in the court. You can say it's been the case with the media, especially the media that only purports one side of the story, but at least there are those media outlets that have multiple guests from multiple points of view, and you can gravitate toward those if you want to have more of a mature dialogue in your brain. In social media, there is never two sides of a story. And if two sides start to emerge, the side that's dominant shuts it down. So it's a danger zone. So I'm going to reread this quote, and I'm going to reread it not for the time in which it took place, late 20th century in the story, but for today. And I'm going to say that social media posters in aggregate are the sword bearers of this century. Words are weapons now. We need to learn how to defend ourselves against them. I just rework the quote. Now, how do we defend ourselves against them? I think you participate in it, and you participate in it in ways that are informative, that are researched, that are measured. And when, not if, you are attacked for sharing what you are sharing that could be very well factual, empirical, and innocuous, ignore. Right. But do not fall into the trap of thinking you can have a dialogue or that you can affect change in a positive way or that you can counter an argument in social media, because that is not why people are out there. They're not out there to learn. They're not out there to hear. They're not out there to discuss. And it would be best left alone.
Whew.
All right, that was a lot, wasn't it?
That was a lot. Yeah. And yeah, it is hard. I mean, I social media is... One of the things that I would say is I do enjoy reading other people's point of view, but you're right. So some people are not open to that. So you do have to be careful. And I have also learned the hard way, Joe, to let things go on social media and to not engage. So it's a hard lesson to learn and a painful lesson to learn.
Yeah, especially for people like you and me that think, hey, if you'll just talk with me about this, I'm sure that we'll see each other clearly. You can do that human to human. You cannot do that in a social media environment.
Right.
All right. So the book segment's yours. You've got a book that that's not new, but new to our audience. We never talked about it before. What are you going to be breaking down for us?
So I love this book, and there's a little bit of a story of me reading this book. So I can't remember now. It's been so long since I remember who told me to read it, but I read a book by Edie Osborne, who I adore, called Firm Forward. And what was great about it was I started reading it, and I didn't know Edie at the time. Like, I didn't know who she was. And I started reading it, and it's an accounting fable. So it's not, it's fictional, but it's the story of a accountant firm, a person in an accounting firm that's looking to, I think he's a partner, and he has a new view on what an accounting firm should look like. Rather than being compliance focused, it should be advisory focused, which isn't new to any one of our listeners. This is, but I do believe that this book was one of the first that really introduced this concept to us, which is one of the reasons I loved it. But the story is that I had no idea who Edie was. I didn't even know who the author was when I was reading this. And it was such a great story. And it's written from the point of view of an accountant named Benny, who is a man. And I had no idea that it was a man, that it was a woman that actually wrote the book. So I read the whole book and I'm like, wow, I really want to connect with this person. And then I realized it was fictional. I didn't realize it was a story. I thought it was actually somebody's autobiography or whatever, you know, something that happened in their life. So I really loved it. I think it's a great book for everybody to read. It's a quick read. It's 200 pages, but it dips into the power of advisory and how it really is the key to your firm transformation, because it kind of unlocks the journey of how you change your thinking around your relationships with your clients. And I still see a lot of our firm owners that, you know, I see through my coaching and through, you know, just meeting other practitioners, that they struggle to get over this mindset, that they're still stuck in the let's churn out as many tax returns as we can. Let's focus on the compliance rather than focusing on those relationships and actually, you know, helping our clients to achieve their goals beyond staying compliant and filing a tax return. So great read. It's a quick read, something you could do, you know, sitting on the beach or sitting in the park on a nice, we're coming into the spring, sitting in the park on a nice sunny day, and well worth the read. So love that book. So I thought I would share that today, John.
And I also think the world of Edie Osborne too. So thank you. Firm Forward is one that I did read many, many years ago. I may take a fresh look at it. It's a little Patrick Lencioni-esque. I don't think she was being derivative. I just think it's a good way to explain it. It's great principles told through a story. Definitely. That's what Patrick Lencioni likes to do. My fun Edie Osborne story, it has no value to our listeners other than just being intriguing, is right after Intuit expanded their campus in Mountain View. They had done this huge remodel in a brand new big building there. They had repaved everything. They put these little decorative pebble lines all throughout the campus. And when you look at them, you know, kind of in whole, it created all these patterns, designs. It was a beautiful thing. But they used these little pebbles that were way too slippery. And it was a rainy day. And Edie Osborne slipped and fell. Now, she was fine. But the very next time I was on that campus, not a month later, every one of those pebbles was gone. So Edie Osborne is affecting change in a lot of ways, including into its campus design. Yes, she's a very influential woman. All right. So that was just me having some fun with that. And if Edie Osborne's listening, you'll remember all too painfully that moment. But it was not your fault, Edie. It was the stone tripped you. So, okay. Now, let's get to the social media posts. I'll let you go first. You've got one that you've teed up. I want to go last for a reason.
Okay. So mine was from Mark Manson, who I love. He's written a couple books that I have in my library. Or maybe I will discuss them later. But his quote was on Twitter, or X, sorry. Old habits die hard, Joe. The trick isn't to get away from the pain. The trick is to find something so important that the pain ceases to matter at all. And I love that quote because that's the truth of it, that when we're driven by our vision, mission, and purposeful living, you're right. He's right. The pain ceases to matter because you have something that you're really striving to change or striving to achieve. So that really inspired me as I was sipping my coffee and thought I'd share it with everybody.
And it is a powerful truth. And as somebody that lives in, with chronic pain, which I do, not debilitating, but still present, if I'm not constantly engaged in things that are purposeful, that are, you know, that matter, that, you know, whatever, then the background noise becomes noise. So, mm-hmm. You know, I live that out every day of my life. It is a powerful truth. Mine is from Albert Campo, but I kind of cheated because Albert Campo he may have some very astute tweets elsewhere, but the one I happened to grab from him was the first tweet that I found by anybody in the universe of X. So that highlighted the fact that the Corporate Transparency Act was deemed unconstitutional by a federal court, a judge out of Alabama, just within the last few days. So the reason I picked Albert Campos' thing is just because I needed to talk about the ruling, given the fact that we just recorded an episode on this BOI or this Corporate Transparency Act. And I need an opportunity to tell our listeners, if you just heard that podcast, you need to know now that it's been challenged in federal court, that there are nuances to the challenge that doesn't completely strike down all aspects of it, but is definitely caused to be placed into question. And if you'll remember, Heather and I were not big fans of the actual way they rolled it out, and the implications that were being placed upon the accounting profession without preparation. I made the statement I thought it was somewhat redundant to some of the things that are already protecting us. And if its purpose is to protect companies from money laundering, which was its primary objective, it wasn't the right hammer for the right nail. We talked about a lot of that last episode that we published. Now this is the update to that one, because we didn't have this ruling at the time we recorded. What we may want to do, Heather's place into the show notes from this show and last show, what's happened since, a little bit of an update. It's very much a moving target. I would encourage you to go listen to our episode, because everything we said is still relevant if BOI does proceed forward, but now that's in question. Okay.
As I said last week, oh boy.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh boy. Because now we don't know what we don't know. Are we going to have, now it's a question of if we even have to do it or not. And if this is appealed successfully, it may be a wait and hurry up for us as an industry.
It could be. And you know, as I mentioned during that podcast episode, that, you know, the AICPA has written a letter regarding this too. So they're getting lots of pressure to So
there's a lot of pressure. I don't know that it will stand, but I do think something will come in to replace it. And perhaps that something will be more measured with the proper regulatory and enforcement procedures on the front side instead of the backside. And hopefully we'll actually address the addressed problem. So I'm not shedding any tears about this court ruling, but I do, for the record, I like the purpose behind it. Mm-hmm. I just don't think it was the right answer. Okay. Let's talk about your favorite article of the week, and that'll wrap us up.
Oh my gosh, I really love this article. So the article that I picked today was four key questions bookkeepers have with their client's tax professional. And that was written by Jody Linick. And I really love this article because it really highlights how bookkeepers and the tax practitioners need to work together for the client's best interest. So having been on both sides of this, you know, Joe, I started as a bookkeeper and then became a tax practitioner and then became a CPA. I've seen this kind of this issue happen a lot. What she discusses is how we have to work together, because the bookkeepers and, you know, are working to keep the books relevant for their client. So they need to make sure that the client is able to make decisions based on their financial information. The tax preparer, their job is to make sure that the tax return is accurately reflected and is, you know, mitigating tax liability. And a lot of times those don't quite reconcile. And so it's really important that these two practitioners are in constant conversation with each other so that they're able to properly service the client. And so she does a really great job of kind of breaking down, what does a bookkeeper need to know? How should they be communicating together in the client's best interest? So great read. I recommend it to everyone.
And I would imagine if somebody has a tax and CAS practice combined, they should still read it to orchestrate internally. Yes.
Definitely.
Absolutely. All right. Well, it's been great spending another 44 minutes and 23 seconds with you, Heather. And I look forward to the next time.
Absolutely. Take care, everyone.
Thank you for joining us. For more information, please visit woodard.com/podcast.